Hey, Junkies, before we kick things off, we want to give a shout-out to our buds, Dion and Blake, over at the podcast Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers. Remember back in the day when you'd have a sleepover with your friends, rent a towering stack of tapes, stuff your sleeping bags full of Fun Dip and Cheese Whiz, and have a fantastic time? Cargill, you must have had those gatherings as a kid, right?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I don't believe
none
that.
None whatsoever. You definitely didn't throw Nintendo games in with the Cheese Whiz.
Oh, no.
You know, you definitely, you know, didn't watch a series of different horror movies after everyone went to bed because they were the movies you weren't supposed to be watching. None of that definitely happened.
No, and you never brought those games that your parents told you not to because you would lose them. It's like, oh, no, I won't take them. And then you just, like, shove them under your socks. Yeah.
Never happened.
No, of course not. Well, Dion and Blake are reliving their childhoods with this nostalgic podcast covering a huge assortment of genres. Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers is like the spiritual cousin of junk food cinema, but you know that it's that cool cousin that you'd always invite to the sleepover because his mom made killer nachos.
Not the hot cousin that makes you feel weird.
Yeah, because it would just make you feel weird and raise a lot of questions you don't want to answer about yourself. So
that's got to be my next 80s cover band, Hot Cousin.
Hot cousin, touching you and feeling some strange things. Hot cousin, don't tell your mom. Yeah, no, we should totally do this. So, after you're done listening to our show and our new band, Hot Cousin, go check out Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers at Saturday Night...
I love that broke you.
I'm just imagining, like a Nikki Sixx and a fucking, what's his name? The other guy from Poison, just like out there like singing about their Hot Cousin. Talk dirty to me, but don't tell anyone because it gets us in a bunch of trouble. So, yeah, once you're done listening to all of this tomfoolery, go check out Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers at saturdaysleepovers.podwitz.com or subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, and just about everywhere else podcasts are available. You can also follow them on Facebook and Twitter.
Out of an age undreamed of. An age of swords and sorcery. An age of demons, dragons, witches, comes the adventure of a sorceress sworn to conquer the world. And mighty, magical women warriors are given the power of sorcery and the fighting skills of the masters.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Adventurers, to another fantastical episode of Junk Food Cinema here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, critic first order of House Waffle, and I am joined by my co-host, my quest companion, Lieutenant of Megaforce, and screen scribe summoner of Doctor Strange, Sir C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
Now, before we go any further, before I mention anything else, I want to make sure that we give a massive, huge, king-size thanks to our Patreon patrons. In just one weekend, we hit our initial goal of earning $100 an episode, which will incidentally go toward keeping the lights on literally in my house, so I can't thank you guys enough. This means that Cargill and I will be producing weekly exclusive bonus episodes just for patrons, so watch your inboxes for the postings of those. The first one's going to hit this week. They'll be mailbag episodes. There'll be bonus movies that we cover in minisode format. We're talking about doing some film commentaries. So we got a lot of cool stuff just for patrons. And on air, I want to thank a few particular patrons as promised. John Allegretti, Nikhil Bhagat, Jose Rivera, and someone, Cargill, I shit you not. At first I thought this might be you, but I don't think it was. Somebody actually became a patron under the name Deputy So-and-So.
Yeah, no, that wasn't me.
So-and-So spelled S-O-H-E-N hyphen S-O-U-G-H. So they came up with two different ways of spelling So. I thought that was, or of So-in. I thought that was pretty good. I also want to announce that we are only a few dollars per episode away from our stretch goal of $200 an episode. And if we hit that, Cargill and I will monthly bring patrons the brand new sub show JFC a la mode. This is where we will review brand new movies in the theaters to see if we can hone our instincts for discovering flicks destined for JFC canon. Sometimes it'll work. Other times we'll probably fail in the quest, but the resulting podcast should be fun either way. So if you have a few bucks to give per episode, please do so. Or if not, or if you already have, help us spread the word so we can slather you up in content. And you know how you can spread that word, guys? JFC is actually on Facebook and Twitter, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema and @junkfoodcinema on Twitter. You can also download our episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, and other various podcatchers. Whenever you hear the word podcatcher, Cargill, do you think of that creepy mincing kid catcher from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang? You remember
that guy? No, but it does sound like a terrible 50s atomic villain.
Right?
Like the the invasion of the podcatchers.
Dr. Goldfoot and the podcatchers. Yeah, no, I hear that. That guy from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, that human nightmare is responsible for more than a few shitty, shitty bedtimes. Oof.
Well, that's our episode. Thanks for tuning in this week.
Thanks for coming. Bye, guys. No, actually, today, in many respects, JFC is going back to the well. And I don't mean that in the sense that it's 6 days from payday and we want to drink whiskey at the bar. Instead, we're going to the well of our revered deity, the great Roger Corman.
Yes.
Yes.
And we're going back to the well of talking about yet another movie that I've shown on 35mm.
You have.
To an audience that had no idea what the fuck they were walking into.
No, it's funny. I believe that was the first time I had seen the movie. I'm almost sure of it, in fact. And this is one of those rare instances, Cargill, where we're covering a movie that I think you have a lot more reverence for than I do. I enjoy this movie just because I am such a big fan of Corman and the schlock that he produces, but it doesn't quite affect me the same way as like a Battle Beyond the Stars or a Death Race 2000. And I think it's one of those movies that you probably have a lot of nostalgia for that I unfortunately missed out on. But I'm excited to talk about it because even in its failures, even in its shortcomings, there's a lot of magic to this movie.
Yeah, no. And the truth is, this is not one that I am madly, deeply in love with from a nostalgic place. This is one of those movies I am madly, deeply in love with because it wants to be a Death Race 2000. It wants to be a Battle Beyond the Stars. Mm-hmm. It had aspirations for that. And this is everything that Corman did done wrong.
Yeah.
And it is such an unbelievable, spectacular, amazing, entertaining failure that I can't help but love it for being that level of failure.
Absolutely.
Like, it's the, when you watch it without context, mm-hmm. it is a baffling, baffling fucking movie.
And we are, of course, talking about the 1982 Sword and Sorcery Weirdo Parade that is Sorceress.
Innocent twins seek revenge against the sorcerer and discover one must die. Evil magic and a battle to control the entire known world.
Sorceress.
Swords and sorcery. Sorceress. Like, even the trailer, even that line in the trailer feels like an afterthought. Like, swords and sorcery. Sorceress?
So
sure, we'll go with that.
So let's just start with how baffling this movie is from the get-go. And let's start with it. let's just begin with the title. Sorceress.
Who's the sorceress of
there
this movie?
There is no sorceress. This movie has no sorceress. Why is the movie called Sorceress? Because they were trying to figure out what to call the movie. They sent out a bunch of people to the movie theater to ask questions about upcoming films. Which mm-hmm. upcoming film would you like to see? And asking a bunch of different titles. And people overwhelmingly responded to the title Sorceress.
According to the internet's movie film database, apparently the title of this particular movie was chosen in that style, in that method that Cargill described, by a high school class. And that's a fact according to IMDb. But it said, yeah, the name of the film was decided when Roger Corman took a list of potential titles to a local high school and polled the students on which they preferred. I would give any amount of money to have been in that high school class and to read that questionnaire that said, like, students, would you like this movie to be called A, Magical Twins, B, Wizard of Darkness, C, Sorceress, or D, Karate Sex Babes? Well, they picked D by a landslide, but those damn censors, I guess we'll just call it fucking Sorceress.
Yeah. All of those other titles would have worked. Karate Sex Babes kind of works. Sorceress?
Not so much.
There is no sorcerer. There's a sorcerer, but of course there was already a movie called Sorcerer, which is pretty fucking awesome.
Yeah, when you think about the other female characters in this film, there are twin martial artists that have, like, the magic that they have only is that they were imbued with the power, with the abilities of a martial artist without having to train. So that's the magical component.
Well, they also have...
So they're magically lazy.
They have plot armor.
That's good.
They have plot armor, and they have magical abilities that they have no idea they have that come into play in the final act to help summon a special effect that was added after the fact.
I can't wait to talk about
that. Oh, yes. So this movie has nothing to do with sorcerers. This movie exists, and this is the beauty of it. This movie exists. I love it.
Put that on the fucking poster. This movie exists.
Okay, so this movie was released in 82. Mm-hmm. It was made in 82. I believe they released it Christmas of 82. This is important to understand because this movie happened because Roger Corman went to see Conan the Barbarian the weekend it opened and came in and sat down with his screenwriter and said, "This is a movie we should have made. I want you to write one just like it. But here's how I want it to be different." And so the screenwriter, who, by the way, is a famous schlock director.
Jim Wynorski.
Yes. Who has done who has written a ton of films and then directed like 50 of them. Such films as The Bear Wench Project.
Oh, yes.
And The Da Vinci Co-ed. And most recently, the Sharkensaw Women's Prison Massacre.
He just never left this period of filmmaking.
Like, no.
He's stuck in a time capsule. Like, he thinks it's still 1982.
Well, except that he's made so many films, he's not wrong. Like, he keeps getting the money to make these movies. He keeps getting actors showing up in, you know, on set. He keeps getting to make them.
This was his first script, followed by Forbidden World, also Chopping Mall.
Chopping Mall is honestly probably his best film.
Take a drink because we will definitely be talking about Chopping Mall at some point.
At some point, Chopping Mall is kind of a great schlock classic from the 80s that is actually genuinely fun.
And Beastmaster 2 Through the Portal of Time.
Like, I was focusing on...
Hey, but don't worry, because he also did Bear Winch Project, so that actually makes up for Portal of Time.
A little bit. Yeah, but so, here's the beauty of this. Corman sat down on Monday with him and said, "I want the script by next Monday." Now, he thought about trying to impress Corman and turning the script in on Friday. But then in his own words, I shit you not, said he wanted to take a couple extra days to make it great.
Mission accomplished.
So this is
way
a movie.
Go, Jimmy.
That when you think about movies that were written in a week and, you know, this, you watch this movie and you're like, you know, how quickly did they write this? Yes, they wrote this in a week. And then instantly brought in one of Corman's workman-like directors,
Jack Hill.
Mm-hmm. Who, by the way...
fucking legend.
Legend. Corman legend. When you talk about people who made some of the best Corman films, he made a number of the Corman blaxploitation flicks.
Coffee and Foxy Brown.
Yeah. And also did... Corman's Philippines shot women in prison movies.
The Big Dollhouse.
And then the also did Wasp Woman, mm-hmm. one of Corman's classics that in true fashion, Corman has remade a couple of times.
Of course. He was also one of the 22 directors on The Terror, I believe.
Was he?
Yeah, he was.
That okay, that fact doesn't surprise
me. We need to maybe on a minisode we'll talk about The Terror, cuz it's not a good movie. It's a confounding, incomprehensible movie, but just the number of people who directed, like, that movie, the story of why it's made and all the people who fucking, like, were directors on that. Go look it up sometime. We'll definitely have to talk about that at some point.
Yeah. So he comes in, and by all accounts, this is Jack Hill's last movie, and this is the sad part of this. Jack Hill may have been nuts at this point.
It's entirely possible.
He may have. I the stories you hear out of people about what he did and how he approached making this movie was unlike what he was on these other films. Like, he and Corman really got along for a long time. They, you know, he made a lot of entertaining, really good movies on Corman budgets that, you know, were among some of Corman's best films. But here he wanted to make, he took this script, which was a sword and sorcery tit fest, and he wanted to make a religious epic out of it.
Yeah.
Like, he wanted to make a deeply spiritual film. One person referred to a religious ballet. And so he made this 2-hour movie that got butchered by Corman to 70 minutes. And then they realized it wasn't feature length. They couldn't release it at 70 minutes. So they had to shoot extra material, which they shot in a single day, to buffer it up an extra 15 minutes. And then they trimmed out 4 minutes of that when it was like, yeah, it's a little long in the tooth again. And there are two versions. And that's what's interesting, is the version that we watched at my birthday was the original theatrical version, because we watched a 35mm print from the American Genre Film Archive. And what was released on DVD, on Blu-ray, actually, because it completely skipped DVD, you could not get this movie for like 30 years. You just could not find it anywhere. That version is the 82-minute version, I think. It's the one that's 4 minutes longer. And it's bizarre.
Yeah.
It's just, the movie just is such a wonderful train wreck. Before we get into completely dissecting it, the thing I want to share is why I fell in love with this thing. Cause I did not see this early in life.
Oh, okay.
This came to me later in life. It was an epic trailer that would end up in a bunch of trailer reels that would play at various events, because the trailer is just so bonkers. But the thing is the first moment the trailer spins up, you know, the first time I saw it, I sat upright in my seat and I'm like, what the actual fuck? Because the trailer uses the music that is used in the movie. And the music in the movie,
speaking of going back to the well,
was entirely pilfered from an earlier Corman film.
Mm-hmm.
It is from a film you junkies should no doubt at this point be familiar with, Battle Beyond the Stars. A film whose score was done by who, Brian?
I believe that would be Little Jimmy Horner.
That would be Little James Horner, his second outing. His first score was for Corman's Humanoids from the Deep. His second score was Battle Beyond the Stars, a score so great that Corman would then rip it off and
again and again and
paste it here again. Badly. Like, there's one or two scenes in this movie that have original music. Everything else is stuff from Battle Beyond the Stars that sometimes works and sometimes is completely incongruous with what's going on in the movie. And they're just trying to make it work. And Corman got in a little trouble for this back in the day, because you aren't supposed to do that. So when I saw this and realized that this movie had the Battle Beyond the Stars soundtrack, I was like, this is my favorite soundtrack of all time. Like, I know every note of this soundtrack. It is just such a beautiful score, and so perfectly executed. And so I was like, Corman actually stole something from an earlier film.
Yeah.
Like, I had known for years that he did it with that James Cameron special effects from Battle Beyond the Stars and plugged that into like a dozen movies over the course of 15 years. But I never realized that he had stolen the actual music from Battle Beyond the Stars. So I was like, I have to see this movie. And then the first time you watch it, this movie is hilarious. Sometimes intentionally.
Other times, not intentionally.
Other times, not so intentionally at all. And it is one of those masterpiece failures.
Yes.
Like
that's a good way to put it.
Everything fails in such a glorious way, and yet there's so much original stuff going on that you're like, what the actual fuck is going on in this movie?
Yeah.
It is spectacularly bizarre. And so let's go through just how weird this fucking movie gets.
Yeah, let's try and break down this plot. You start off with an evil wizard named Trigon, who learns that he must sacrifice his firstborn child to the god Caligara so that he can achieve master power. Caligara, I believe, is also a brand of soap, so she's got that going for her. But the wizard's wife, after giving birth to twin daughters, flees with the girls. She gets tracked down, but unfortunately for Trigon, because the girls are twins, and because he's also the kind of lazy-ass, barely-there dad who couldn't be bothered to be in the delivery room, he doesn't know which girl was born first.
He didn't even know they were twins.
He didn't know there were two of them, yeah.
And when he finds out, he has no idea which one's born first, and he cannot anger his god by sacrificing the wrong child.
Yeah, it's basically the infant version of that scene in every episode with an evil twin where it's like, I don't know which one's the real one, I don't know which one to shoot. So before the wife dies, before anything can escalate of this, an old warrior named Krona shows up and keeps Trigon from killing either of them. And before the wife dies, she hands them over to Krona, who promises to raise them both as great soldiers. And much like Obi-Wan Kenobi, apparently raising them to be great soldiers means dumping them off with some farmer and have at. Good life. Hope it works out for you. You'll never see me again until I'm almost dead.
You know, and right from the get-go, you see where the screenwriter was bringing some interesting ideas. Like, there's
not necessarily his ideas, but
well, no. Like, there's I love the fact that, you know, the two wizards are about to have their, you know, little kerfuffle in the opening scene of the movie, and we find out there that these wizards have three lives. And
yes.
And he doesn't know, the good guy doesn't know
like
which
third,
life.
They're a third of a cat apiece.
Yeah, so, but I thought that was, I really like that idea. I think it's cool. It's like, yeah, one of the things of the wizards is they get three lives. And, aha, our bad guy is only on his first life. So he's totally fine getting killed by this good wizard who we subsequently learn is on his third life. So he's dumped them off with farmers. To be raised by farmers as boys.
Yeah, and before that happens, this opening scene illustrates something that will plague the movie until the end, which is the complete subversion of any dramatic stakes, because every time an arrow is fired or a spear is chucked or a sword comes down, we are treated to the most Hanna-Barbera of sound effects you could possibly imagine. Like, it was as if, yeah, it was as if Birdman and Space Ghost were firing arrows at these children. Or it was just like somebody would get hit with an arrow and be like, shoo, shoo. I'm like, I don't understand. Is Birdman, like, flying away? I don't know what's happening right now.
Yeah, I don't know if they did live sound on this movie
or not.
No,
it was definitely added in
post.
No.
The thing is that this movie is ADR.
Oh,
They shot this movie in Mexico, in Mexico City. And I can't tell if certain actors are only speaking Spanish, much like many of the Italian films that we cover here. And then several others are speaking English, and then they dub over depending on where it is.
I have the answer to this, and it is, you are entirely right. A lot of these actors are not speaking a lick of English. And this movie actually has the most flagrant example of ADR conversation I've ever seen, when the Viking Baldar is speaking to the sword maker about polishing his sword. The camera is on his face, and he is having a conversation, but he must be a master fucking Viking ventriloquist, because his mouth never moves throughout the course of the entire conversation. Just doesn't, like, not that it doesn't match the words, it doesn't move.
He's an interesting case where they made him a Viking, and so he's got this big Viking mustache covering his mouth, so you can never tell that he's not speaking whatever is coming out of his mouth.
You would think that, but in this scene, it's clear that, like, if he started drinking a glass of water, you would still hear his voice.
I'm convinced that the scene that you're talking about in particular is one of the scenes that they shot of the 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Because that scene, it's literally him talking about his sword, and he's talking about... it's a new metal techniques, and there's this 2-minute conversation about these newfangled metal techniques from faraway lands.
And then it's like, polish it. No, don't polish it. No, go ahead. And I'm like, are we watching these characters run errands? What is going on right now?
Yeah.
Why is this happening?
I'm convinced that it's that, and I'm convinced they buffered out the gambling scene.
When we
first meet him, because that gambling scene goes on.
Goes on and on.
And it's like, yeah, these are the scenes where, because they literally brought together everyone who was working on the production. It was people from behind the scenes. They put them in costumes and they just kind of had them go. So I'm convinced that section of the movie is where all of that buffering happened.
Would not be surprised. So 20 years pass. The two infants have grown into mystical Playboy centerfolds.
Actual Playboy centerfolds.
They're actual Playboy centerfolds.
These were Playboy playmates.
These are Playboy playmate twins, Leah and Lynette Harris.
Who don't know their girls.
They...
The most bizarrely baffling point of this whole movie is that these large-breasted, beautiful centerfolds have been raised, told that they're boys, and don't know the difference between boys and girls, and so have no idea that they are different in any way from the men they end up fighting alongside.
They've been taught so little about their own bodies or about people or about life in general that it seems like they come from a village that is nestled soundly on the spectrum. Like, that's how little they know about anything. You're just like... Is there something wrong with... Did, like, some of that magic end up touching them a little bit? Because I'm not sure they're all there. Like, that's how little they know. It's like, they don't even know what the difference between... They're not, like, young girls. They're in their fucking 20s, and they're like, I don't know what a guy is or what a girl is. And it's just like, oh, this is embarrassing
so
for
this
everyone.
This is the moment where you realize you are in for something very different than you normally expect. Because as it turns out, Sorceress isn't so much Conan the Barbarian as it's a fantasy sex comedy.
It's Conan the Barbarass is what it is. It's a movie that actually takes place in a further subgenre of sword. It's swords, sorcery, and gratuitous nudity is the subgenre that this is in. There's more TNA in this movie than in the word tattletale. It is absurd. It is fucking absurd. Well, you know what? More than the phrase tattletale eating tater tots on a rattling tater totter. That's how many fucking TNA moments there are in this movie. It's insane.
It's so blatant. Like my favorite moment that really kind of tells you just what kind of movie this is when they're having the discussion and first discovering that they're boys. And
that they're girls
and the their traveling companions are like, you didn't notice there's something different, and they both just open their shirts, reveal their breasts, and they're like, you mean these? And it's like, oh, come on. But the thing is there are moments where the comedy surrounding this is actually kind of funny.
And it complements, and I think that's what keeps this movie from being like unwatchable, is like, there are moments where what's supposed to be funny is funny, and then it's complemented by the things that aren't necessarily supposed to be funny also being funny, which makes this a more effective comedy than like some of the comedies I've seen now where everything is supposed to be funny.
Yeah, it's one of those that you just watch it and you're like, what the actual fuck? Like, yeah. I don't, like, there's no way. Like, this is a thing that exists. Dumb.
You're right. The more I think about it, this movie exists is a very interesting running theme for the entire discussion.
Yeah.
Because every few minutes you have to stop, you take an inventory and remind yourself, this movie exists.
It played in theaters. Like, people paid money on opening weekend. Like, they packed houses. They packed houses because everyone was so... It was 82. You had just had the greatest summer in the history of movies.
Absolutely.
All of a sudden, you've got fantasy films coming out. You've got science fiction films coming out. You've got great horror movies coming out. The genre is
evolving. Like I literally just last weekend watched, you guys have heard me talk about Night Flight in the past, and Night Flight just celebrated its 35th anniversary of the first episode airing. And they celebrated by posting their first entire whole episode on their streaming service.
Oh, wow.
Now, if you haven't checked out their streaming service yet, you should. If the 80s is your jam, specifically, you know, and nostalgia, from other eras, the Night Flight was just choked with it. It was an era that was very much like our era now, that was experimenting with the format of television. And so they were being nostalgic for music of the 60s and pop culture and counterculture of the 70s. And they were in love with the kitsch of the 50s, the way that we're in love with some of the kitsch of the 80s. And then they were also absolutely fascinated by the 30s. So like it's this weird echo of watching these episodes. And the episode that they just posted, the full episode, had one of the things Night Flight always did is they had a thing called Take Off To. And it was Take Off To This. And it was, we're going to talk about this thing for whatever the for half an hour or an hour, and sometimes it's women in rock, or it's Take Off To animation and music videos, or there's a great episode, Take Off To cult films. This one was Take Off To special effects, and it was all about the films that were coming out at the time and talking about the special effects. And it knocked a couple movies, gave gentle elbows to a couple films, and then lauded to others as being, you know, amazing, unbelievable. And the five films they talked about, they focused on for special effects, were Tron, Blade Runner, Poltergeist. Those are the three they kind of knocked around. Like, they actually talk about how the story in Poltergeist is falls second to the special effects in the movie, and it's kind of weird in hindsight to actually hear somebody say that, and it's kind of like, that's Poltergeist. That's one of the greatest horror movies ever made. So this is, you know, this is the summer we're talking about. So anything that's got a cool looking poster, people were rushing out to see. They had seen Conan that year. We'd gotten The Dark Crystal that year, you know, Rocky III, you know, of course, this is the summer of Megaforce. This is the summer of Q the Winged Serpent. Like, even the bad movies were glorious.
Yeah.
And here comes Sorceress, and people love this poster and they love the title Sorceress, and they walk into this weird fantasy sex comedy with, by the way, we've gotten a little further. We have not talked about the masturbating goat man.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
So, this movie has a masturbating goat man. We really should have led with that.
My fucking God. So these two twins are introduced, Nudesville, swimming in a pond, and they're observed by the movie's creepiest creepy creeper, Pando the Satyr, one horny goat.
Who apparently has a very large dick that they never bother to show us.
What's
but
that
is
between his legs? Is that a weapon? Like, really? How stupid are these? Come on.
There are three different Pando dick jokes in the movie.
If I had a nickel for every Pando dick joke,
I'd have 15 cents.
I'd have more than they spent on the movie Sorceress.
It's like this is how they introduced to us that the girls don't know they're girls because they don't know what a penis looks like.
Yeah.
And so we've got masturbating goat man.
How about this interaction between the twins and Pando?
And how about everyone's interaction with Pando? Pando doesn't speak. Pando's just meh,
just
meh,
goat noise.
Meh. And he doesn't really do anything with them, except that whenever they get into trouble, he like runs off and ants at people, and then gets people to show up and help.
Yeah, he has his one big heroic moment at the end of the movie that isn't that heroic.
No, well, there's that, and then there's he has the exact same moment halfway through when the twins get captured. He runs off to tell our heroes.
He's basically, you know what he is? He's a horny version of Lassie.
Yes.
That's what he does.
Yes.
Go get help, girl. Go get help.
Yeah, that's exactly who Pando is. And it's like, why is there a masturbating goat man in this movie? And why is he only serving as a plot device? Like, why, you know, what is this?
This has to be the first time we've ever been able to use the sentence,
masturbating,
why is there a masturbating goat man?
Why is there a masturbating goat man in this movie? And yet, the appliance on his face is so creepy.
Oh my God.
And the way he dances around watching the girls, and the, you know, there's another scene where later in the movie where and we'll get to this crazy fucking scene when one of the girls is kind of in orgasmic pleasure, and he gets really excited, and then goes to, you know, like, is moving towards her, and, you know, the other character is like, no, stay away from her. Do not touch her. She is under my protection.
That face appliance, talk about shitty bedtimes. Enjoy your nightmares, kids.
And so he actually looks super disappointed that he's not allowed to hop on and rape this girl. And so he goes off into the bushes alone and you know, and is like, try to find a cold shower.
Which hasn't been invented yet, so I'll just jerk my goat dick.
It's like, oh my God, like, we have a character actively leaving the room to go masturbate.
Yeah.
Like, dear Christ, Pando, I mean, the masturbating goat man.
Everyone in the audience is doing the same thing. We're just not talking about it. I mean, come on. The funny thing about Pando, apparently, was supposed to be played by Sid Haig.
Oh, yeah.
Who was buddies with Jack Hill and has appeared in a number of Jack Hill's films, including Spider Baby, Foxy Brown.
But here, in true to form, Corman didn't want to pay Sid Haig's exorbitant salary.
Which was probably scale. He didn't want to pay him the exorbitant price of scale.
Yeah, it's Sid Haig in 1982, not somebody who's commanding $1 million a movie.
No.
And Sid Haig as the masturbating goat man
would have been amazing.
That kind of would have been a sentence we would have heard before.
Yeah, right?
Like, so,
I would have remembered a Sid Haig masturbating goat man. I feel like these are so many words that shouldn't go together are going together in this episode. So a not quite David Carradine looking henchman shows up in the village where the two girls have been raised, murders their fictive family. Very upsetting scene where they rape the girl's sister and then kill her. And the girls use their martial arts skills, which they learned at the Dojo of the Blue Cellophane in camera effect. And they fight off the invaders, and they put an arrow into the David Carradine-looking henchman, but he survives. And that's when Hagar the Horrible shows up, otherwise known as the Viking character Baldar.
Also known as Volstagg, you know, like, he's... Yeah. This character clearly was stolen straight out of a Thor comic.
Well, you know, one of the things I love about low-budget fantasy filmmaking is that it makes the filmmakers not beholden to just one mythology.
Yeah.
Sorceress is like a mythic food court with options from all cultures and all times. I mean, there are Vikings, there are barbarian, there are, like, very obviously Asian-influenced martial artists, belly dancers. I think pirates and Eskimos show up at one point.
And let's not forget the very Aztec end of this movie.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God, very Aztec. Like, it's like that scene in Pee-wee's Big Adventure where they're just wandering around the Warner Brothers lot and everyone's in costumes for different movies. This is the nexus point of a lot of different movies going on.
Yeah, no, this is a true pastiche of what was happening to, you know, in cinema at the time. Written in a week, slapped together in Mexico, and then a climax added for a poster.
Yeah.
And we'll get to that.
Oh, we will get to that.
See, now you're starting to understand why I love this movie.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those things that I like, and this is why the non-irony thing still kicks in, because the legitimate enjoyment I get out of this movie is knowing the strange road that it took to get made and all of the weird things that had to happen to culminate into its production. I am obsessed with stories like that.
And on top of it, it's not like this is a movie that it kind of breaks your heart, because this could have been a great movie and there were a couple artists really working very hard to make an epic film and then they got fucked over. Everybody knew they were making garbage and they were slapping garbage out and they were trying to make garbage that would entertain the audience, and they ended up making a movie that I find very entertaining.
You know, you say that and I agree with that for the most part, but one of the weird things about this movie is I hear so many times people excuse cult and B-movie filmmakers because they knew they weren't adapting Shakespeare, they knew what they were aiming for, blah, blah, blah. The mitigating and yet somehow still aggregating factor about Sorceress is that I believe this movie is at times, and I think this is the Wynorski script, is still aiming for something way loftier than it is. And by that I mean the level of world-building babble, the mystical nonsense,
yeah,
is delivered in this movie with pomp and circumstance of like a graduation ceremony in Middle Earth. Like, if it just, it's insane. Like at the very beginning of the movie, they're talking about, you know, how many clicks to this next area, and you have to hide it because of this stone, and like, it is clear that the mythology of this film started being developed hours before the movie started. You know what I mean? Like, in terms of the narrative, like, we came in the middle of a much bigger story, like, that has been here forever. Like, nobody is taking lightly the actual narrative of the movie and adding all of this. Like, if you watch, like, the actual character of Baldur, and whenever he speaks, or more accurately, whenever the person in the recording booth speaks for him, those lines have just so much, like, oh, it is my honor to serve you. This is a revenge quest. They have entered into a pact of revenge. Like, there is not a throwaway line in this movie. There's no such thing as a throwaway line in this movie.
Yeah, no. That's because this movie that barely qualified for being a feature film. Like, it's, yes, like, there's no way to do this without the movie making no goddamn sense at all.
Well, plus, if you break down the plot, it is heavily stealing from Star Wars.
Oh, what you mean the abandoned twins?
Hidden from their evil father.
Trained
by an old master,
living at a farmhouse where their aunt and uncle are then killed.
Yes, absolutely, which brings them into the fray of a much bigger conflict.
Although I will say,
then it sets them on a quest which necessitates a roguish gambler living in a wretched hive of scum and villainy. Yeah. It's fucking stealing from Star Wars. Yeah.
Although the twin thing I will say is actually theirs. That they didn't steal from Star Wars because Jedi had not come out yet, and nobody knew that fucking secret.
That's true. That's a good point.
Like, all we knew in 82 was Darth Vader's his father, and we don't know how that works. We have no idea that Leia is.
That's a good point.
Like, at that point, there was still Luke and Leia fanfic. Like, so, that was still a thing.
What if we actually proposed that this was the one thing missing from the Jedi script, and Lucas sees this and goes, oh, well, it'd be better if they were related, so maybe I'll just make them brother and sister. And he's hiding both of them. No, wait. No, you know what? I take that back, because he says there is another. Yoda says there is another. So anyway, I'm talking in circles about Star Wars because
this movie,
because otherwise all I can think about is a masturbating goat man.
But you know what? And see, here's the thing: is this is not the only fantasy film, the only terrible fantasy film we've ever watched that stole whole hog from Star Wars.
Oh, I believe it.
Aragorn is beat for beat Star Wars. Like, at least Sorceress
Dragon movie?
Yes.
I don't even remember that movie.
Oh, yeah. If you ever sit down and rewatch Aragorn, you'll be like, holy shit, this is literally Star Wars. Huh. Like, everything about, like, he meets the rogue and they go save a princess from the castle. And, you know, the knight that trained him in his magical powers sacrifices himself and dies. And then he's got to fight this evil wizard on the back of a dragon, who we find out it may be his father. Like, it's literally, you know, it's literally Star Wars. This is literally Star Wars in the first act.
Oh, for sure. I mean, and it's up to the point where we go to our own version of Mos Eisley,
yeah,
looking for our Han Solo character.
Yes.
And by the way, we were talking about this off mic. You watch this scene where they did the establishing shot of this city.
Oh, my.
And I remember thinking this about a lot of Corman movies. What's the other one? Where the guy goes back in time with his, like, annoying little friend, and, like, Jack Palance is the villain. Do you know the one I'm talking about? It's like they've made fun of it on Mystery Science Theater, but in all those movies like that, you get this shot of the, like, papier-mâché basically village that they put together, and there's always it's framed in such a way that there's so much sky, and it's like, why are we seeing so much sky instead of just pulling the camera down and trying to contain the shitty scope of this terrible little village that you've put up with probably, you know, cardboard? And when we watch the interviews on this Blu-ray, it starts to explain not only why this shot looks this way, but why a lot of Corman shots look this way.
Oh, yeah.
And that apparently Jack Hill was told that they were going to put in matte paintings of like castles and epic fantastical landscapes. Yeah, we're going to
this village is a small village right at the base of the hill of this large fantastic castle in the background. It's going to look great. We have the best castles, we have the best matte paintings.
Are you doing Trump right now?
These are the best matte paintings in the world. You're going to love our matte paintings.
You know what? You know, this castle's going to be huge. It's going to be huge right behind the village. It's going to look great. I know a lot of villages. I know a lot of castles. It's going to look wonderful.
We have the best castles.
We have the best castles. We have all the best castles.
But then Corbin comes along and says, we're not spending money on matte paintings. The shots look fine.
Yeah.
And so now we're supposed to be in this big, huge, epic city, you know, and be kind of drawn into the vistas. No. It's a cheap set of a village. And there's like 30 people walking around and that's it, and it's like, oh
yeah,
oh wow.
Instead of matte paintings, you're looking for like power lines because that's how high up the fucking framing of the shot is.
It adds to how small it makes the movie feel.
Yeah,
like it's an epic fantasy taking place in a village of 30 people. It's kind of nutty that way. It's imagine if you were watching Game of Thrones and they didn't put in the digital effects and you just watched all these people in costume walking around England.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like, oh, okay. This is one of those. This was a few matte paintings away from actually looking like a real movie, but it doesn't. So it adds to the wondrous air of masturbating goat men and half-naked kung fu twins and a sorceress that doesn't exist.
Sorceress. This movie exists. Sorceress. Almost a movie. We're really doing a lot for the marketing campaign. And here's where we meet Erlich the Barbarian, who is played by Roberto Nelson, who to me kind of looks like William Catt, but worse. Like, maybe
he's the William Catt you get when you can't get William Catt.
He's the lamest American hero. He's the one you get when you can't get William Catt. And he's a guy who is from noble birth, but spends his days cheating at dice and getting in fights and blah, blah, blah. He's a rogue. He's your basic rogue.
Yeah, he's your basic rogue. And he's sly with the women. And the women do love their Erlich.
They love their Erlich. And then it's at this point that the evil wizard, his evil Lynn female accomplice, the not quite Carradine, and an honest to goodness, shit you not, man in a monkey costume. They're throwing everything at the fucking wall with this movie.
Did you think that the masturbating goat man was the end of how weird this movie gets?
I was hoping.
Oh, no.
I was hoping we'd hit that peak.
Now we get the evil character that's a monkey.
Who is promised one of the twins.
A rape-tastic monkey, by the way.
Every animal in this movie wants to rape things.
Who is denied later in the film his ability to rape one of the twin girls, and then joins the good guys as a result. Yeah. Like, that is the strangest motivation I've ever seen in one of the strangest scenes, because how does he go and join the good guys? He goes and finds the masturbating goat man, and they have a conversation that we cannot even begin to understand.
I'm
formulating a plan we cannot fathom that ultimately ends up with them showing up at the end with goat herders and goats. And like, it's just like they have a parade through the city. Like, what the? It's like none of this makes any goddamn sense.
Conversations between Itchy and Mala in the holiday special of Star Wars make more goddamn sense than this scene.
Yes.
And I imagine, given these two characters, that they communicate entirely by circle jerk. Like, that is the only way these two guys can send and receive messages.
What is up with these rape-tastic animals in this movie?
Why are the animals so goddamn horny in this movie? What is going on? Everything's in heat. Simply everything is in heat.
Well, I mean, that's the craziness of it is, when you watch the trailer, if you have not seen this movie yet, and you watch the trailer going, what the fuck is this movie? I've never heard of it. You're going to be like, oh, this looks like a very cheap, fun adventure movie. This movie, it's got a little comedy in it, but until somebody's told you that it is mostly a fantasy sex comedy, you watch this movie going, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's 13 different shades of insane.
Like, yeah, and for such a short movie, they cram an awful lot of that in there.
They cram a lot of different movies into this one movie. So this cadre of villains show up in the city. They capture the girls. And this is the part that I really struggled with. They devise a way to determine which twin was born first using fire?
Using magic?
Question mark. But they're like, the fire always knows, and I'm like, what the fuck does that? What? But what did it do? You just burned her face. Like, I don't.
No.
You have to explain what the fuck you're doing. No,
the thing is it didn't burn her face, and because the fire didn't burn her, she was clearly the firstborn. So now we know who the firstborn is, so that we can properly sacrifice her.
So the fire is the shadow; it always knows.
It's literally gobbledygook. Like, it's just like, we need some magical way. Hey, what if we put her face in a fire? That would look expensive.
Yeah. Take her back to the castle, give her this magic Mountain Dew potion that turns her, like, submissive.
The glow stick Mountain Dew.
The glow stick Mountain Dew. And then you give Lesser William Cat the same, so they're, like, on board with the whole, like, we're going to help you, and then she's going to sacrifice herself so that Caligara will bless our evil wizard with power, and that leads to the big finale involving a floating head.
Hold on. No. No, you passed up some excellent what the fuck in there.
Have I?
Oh, yeah. The part where our sorcerer animates an army of the dead.
Wait, I thought that happens after the floating head shows
up. No. Okay.
Well, you know what? I will say, this is the one part of the movie that I actually really do like. Like, yes. Legitimately. The scene in the catacombs, those zombies are legit creepy at the onset. Like, I'm watching a tits-out fantasy movie, and then suddenly a Fulci film starts up.
Yeah.
Like, all of a sudden I'm in the beyond, and it actually works pretty well. And I think the design of the Evil Dead characters, pretty damn impressive.
Oh, yeah, no. The creature work, the creature work on this budget is really kind of amazing. Like, the goat, the masturbating goat man's facial prosthetic aside, mm-hmm. which is creepy in the way it should be creepy, by the way. Like,
yeah,
that's
it doesn't look like it's poorly made. Right. It's unsettling.
It's unsettling. But yeah, you know, the man in a monkey suit looks like a man in a monkey suit, but it's a really cool animatronic monkey suit that has, you know, that has actual facial features and looks good for a Corman budget. And these zombies look really fucking cool.
Well,
the catacombs look cool. Like, this is the one scene in the movie that legitimately looks like has great production design and looks like a real fucking movie, which is why when you watch the trailer, that scene's all over it.
Well, that's because the effects are done by John Carl Beekler, who also did effects for movies like, oh, I don't know, The Dungeon Master and Trancers and From Beyond. So, I mean, this is a guy whose work has been impressing us for a long time. He did the effects for Halloween 4. He did special animatronic effects for The Last Crusade, Bride of Reanimator. So, yeah, it's not surprising to me that you look at this movie and you see that even though they were cutting corners on literally everything, John Carl Beekler is still able to pull off some impressive effects. So, yes, we have a descent into the catacombs, zombies coming up out of the ground, but then because this is a Corman movie, because this is fantasy with the T and the A in bold, as soon as the zombies hit the earth, they come out of the ground, they go right for the virgins, and there's a line delivered by Baldur where he's like, well, they've been dead for 1,000 years, what do you expect? And it's just like, wow.
Zombie
porn.
Yeah, like, it's, you assume,
son of the dick.
Like, the first time you watch, you assume that the zombies are taking the virgins because they're the sacrifice and they're hungry, you know, they're zombies.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh no, that was all an elaborate sex joke.
Yeah.
And now we get to the point where our evil goddess has been summoned and is waiting for the sacrifice.
Oh my god, this whole sequence of a floating head versus a bat lion, it's hilariously lame, but its very existence in the movie is not only the essence of what I genuinely love about the labor pains of bad movies, but also why you can't help but admire just the complete testicular fortitude of someone like Roger Corman.
Testicular fortitude.
He figured out, this is a true fucking story because he talks about it in the interviews on this Blu-ray. Oh, yeah. He figured out that whenever he produced a film in which something flies that doesn't normally fly, the movie does well. And again, I'm now,
think about that for a second, yeah, just, listeners. Think about that. He surmised
that his lightning in a bottle is shit flying that shouldn't be flying.
Like, that's what, in 1982, that's what people wanted. So he thought, he was trying to think of things that don't fly. Oh my that God. Would be cool if they flew.
Can you imagine being part of that focus group? Is that how they finalized the design of the spaceship in Battle Beyond the Stars? It was like a focus group where they're like, which of the following items in flight would most pique your interest? A, a bird. B, a jet. C, a pair of astro tits. Or D, a kite.
Or is it E, fallopian tubes?
Fallopian tubes.
So think about that. So he goes, I know, a lion. That would be cool.
That's the celluloid scientist we're working with in Roger Corman, a guy who's like, shit that flies that shouldn't fly, go Batlight.
And, by the way, he wanted it just for the trailer and the poster.
Yeah, it wasn't part of the script. It wasn't in the story. So he decides he's going to add a bat lion that is not in the script. He puts it in the trailer. He puts it on the poster. So they then have to retcon a reason for its entire existence.
Well, but that's the beauty of it, was he actually never planned on putting it in the movie. But it turned out so cool, he's like, this has to be in the movie.
Yeah.
And so, yes. So you can actually, if you're paying attention to what they're talking about in the woo-woo of going on in the scene, what is going on in the sky between these two gods? Which what is going on, by the way, is they're growling at each other.
Nothing is going on.
They're literally looking at each other in the stars, growling at each other. Grr, grr, grr. And then finally, our flying lion creature shoots a laser at the evil goddess creature, who then blows up.
There's so much waiting around. The flying lion shows up like, Hey guys, I'm here. Not sure what to do. So I'll just I'll make the same pose for 10 minutes because I'm a goddamn puppet. I'm a hand puppet. So I'll just make this pose until one of my bolts of face lightning take out the girly star face with grayscale.
Early on in the script, we are told we are given a Deus Ex Machina. There, we're told, remember the name of your god, say this word, and it will get you out of trouble. Like, they've been in all this trouble the whole movie, they don't use it. It's that kind of a, so you know it's coming up, and so they...
save it for the third act, why don't you?
They say the line, and I'm guessing in the original story that saying the line is just what breaks the spell of Magical Mountain Dew that has our two of our heroes trapped and about
to
sacrifice.
I think we figured out what the junk food pairing for this episode's going to be.
Spoiler warning.
We're both talking like Miracle Max too, which is also funny.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's
fun storming the Aztec temple.
It's like Mountain Dew with roofies in it. Like, yes. That's, you know, we missed my favorite scene in the movie, but we'll jump back to that.
I mean, you might as well now, because there's the, you know what? Batlion will wait.
Yeah.
Because that's what he does in this movie. So talk about the other
while thing. While our heroes have been captured, they drink this magical potion, which makes them, you know, really horny and have sex with one another. And, well, this is where we find out, by the way,
it's that called Cosby Doo.
Yeah, it's the Cosby. So we found out that the twins have always been able to see what the other sees and feel what the other feels.
Oh my God, yeah. We mentioned this, but we did not delve into it. Oh my God.
Oh yeah. Yeah. In what is the strangest fucking nonsensical, hilarious, awesome moment in this fucking movie is our roguish hero and our better actress of the sisters.
Sure. Split hairs. Why not?
Well, one of them went on to act in 4 films and the other only did played her twin sister in another film.
Yeah. Again, splitting hairs.
but they go off and they have this moment together and they're fucking, you know, not on screen. Because this is a TNA movie, not a sex film.
This is not the Bear Winch Project, guys.
Yeah, so, or the Da Vinci Co-ed. That's actually my favorite. That's my favorite play on it, because it's like, wow, you literally just shifted a letter. That's,
you know why I like porn
awesome.
Titles? You know why I like porn titles? It's all puns.
It's all puns.
All puns.
So what happens is we've got our masturbating goat man, we've got our Viking, and then we've got our other twin who starts experiencing the lovemaking without anyone being there. So all of a sudden she's feeling funny. She's trying to explain the feeling between her legs. She's writhing around in ecstasy. And what does our Viking keep doing? Oh,
what?
That must be Ehrlich. And then
it's weird that you know him that well.
Well, that's what's so, you're just like, what the fuck? Because he's like, oh, it must be Ehrlich. And you're like, oh, there's a bro, like, you know, doing a bro. And then she's really getting into it. He goes, oh, that's Ehrlich, all right.
Why do you know this?
And now she's in the full throes of practically, you know, diddling herself right there on the ground, writhing around. He goes, oh, it's definitely Ehrlich. And it's like,
stop saying that immediately. Dude, do you want to fuck Ehrlich?
Dude, you just made it weird. made it weird.
Which is impressive considering how weird this already
was. And then he has to chase off the masturbating goat man who then goes off to masturbate in the woods. Like, it's like, this is a scene in a movie. This is an actual movie. Like, there is a scene in which a twin rides around enjoying her twin getting banged by our hero who is that while creeping. Creepy, you know, wingman is like, that's my boy, all right. And then masturbating goat man wants to rape our one of our other protagonists before going off to jerk off into the woods. It's an actual scene in an actual movie. Why do I love this movie? Because it exists.
Because
that's why
it exists. This movie absolutely does exist. And one of the other weird things that I found about this is that director Jack Hill claims that Dino De Laurentiis, who was filming Dune in the same studio, stole this movie's lighting equipment for his own production. So, again, just all of the behind-the-scenes stuff, and then all of what is only trumped by the weirdness that you actually see on screen in this completely bizarre, total weirdo parade that kind of has to be seen in order to be believed. And that is Sorceress. And just take a look at the poster, the original poster for this movie. It has a really great-looking flying lion that does not look like what we got in the film. Has a really great looking version of the ape man holding an axe, which is not what we got in the film, and has only one of the two blondes. So clearly this was made before any casting decisions were made. So interesting stuff for sure.
Source and sorcery. Sorceress.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing, which of course is going to be a giant glass of Mountain Dew.
With a glow stick in it.
With a glow stick in it.
Drop a glow stick in it, drink the Mountain Dew, and you will get the biggest, most costly special effect in this movie.
Yes, and hopefully it will poison your senses to the point that this movie actually makes sense to you. Yeah, Mountain Dew with a glow stick in it. That is the junk food pairing for Sorceress. And that's going to do it for this week's episode. Hope you guys have enjoyed it. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema, and consider becoming a patron if you would. We are just a few dollars per episode away from Junk Food Cinema a la mode, which I'm very excited about, so please get on that as well. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/massaworm, M-A-S-S-A-W-Y-R-M, and on Facebook, facebook.com/massaworm.
Awesome. And you can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find my Facebook page, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And before we go, I just want to give one more shout out to Dion and Blake over at Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers, and let them take it from here. And until next week, just stay away from masturbating goat men.
Do you remember a time when sleeping on the floor with your friends wouldn't have been considered weird? The management of this website invites you to a new dimension in podcasting, an experience so fun it could only be compared to a childhood sleepover. It's not just about horror.
Tom Atkins proves that any man is leading man material.
It's not just about action.
If you're going to rank Van Damme movies,
yeah, it's up there.
I'd put it top five.
It's not just about comedy.
There's no other person in the world that loves Weekend at Bernie's more than you.
It's not just about science fiction.
Hang a scrim with, like, a beautiful comb over.
It's about nostalgia. Can you survive the Saturday Night Movie Sleepover? It's not a movie. It's a podcast about movies.
You can follow Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers at SaturdaySleepovers.podwitz.com. That's SaturdaySleepovers.podwitz.com. On Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, Player FM, and Stitcher.